Good morning, Your Honor. Richard Westfall of the law firm of Hale Westfall, appearing here today on behalf of defendants Odalogix and the individual defendants. I would like to use most of my prepared time to address the apportionment and reserve the apportionment argument and to reserve as much time as I possibly can for time of rebuttal. But first, I'd like to point out three specific points to the court that don't directly relate to the apportionment argument, but I want to make sure the court I get out before I lose my time. First point is that regards to the actual evidence in this case and what it involves. I would like to call the court's attention to pages 8 and 9 of the plaintiff's answer brief and also to pages 19 and 20. It's at that place where the defendant, or excuse me, the plaintiff attempts to make showing to this court what are the actual damages that are at issue in this case. And I ask the court to look at those pages carefully and the argument that, and the points that are raised by the plaintiff carefully, because I think it shows two things. Number one, it's an admission that the evidence that they're presenting to this court and they presented to the trial court below is nothing more than this amorphous lost profits evidence, nothing more than that. Second, they admit that essentially all of their evidence is subsumed within their expert witness, damages expert, Mr. Hall, and that his theories really do entail the evidence that they were relying upon to establish damages in this case. The second point I'd like to make appears.
So are you saying there's no evidence to support their damage number?
There is insufficient evidence
to support their damage number? Is that what you're saying to us now?
There is evidence to support damages with respect to lost profits. But the core of our argument is that apportionment needed to be done, the comparative fault statute needed to be complied with in this particular case. And because it was not, we clearly have a record that establishes two critical things. Number one, that there was duplication. Number two, that the aiding, abetting, and tortious interference tort claims completely dwarfed the actual damages from the underlying tortious interference and breach of contract itself.
I don't want to take you off track, but what I started to hear you say was there's insufficient evidence, and repeatedly in your brief you say this is not an argument about insufficient evidence, yet sometimes I read your brief to say that, and I don't know what to believe. I don't know which it is.
That's why I'm focusing on the actual evidence in the case, because if in fact they did have some distinguishing evidence where they could show that Odalogix did some harm separate and apart from the individual actors, and they could point to it beyond this amorphous argument of lost profits, this amorphous theory of lost profits, then maybe our apportionment argument wouldn't be so strong. Maybe our argument about duplication wouldn't be so strong. But they don't have that. What you have is you have thrown above this concept of amorphous concept of lost profits damages against the wall, running some theories around in front of the jury and seeing what they can make stick. That's why it shows that it's one of the manifestations, if you will, of the harm that was caused and why we need a new trial on damages, because there was a failure to apportion, which I think is the core of our argument. The last point I'd like to make is, again, related to those last points, is with respect to the inconsistency argument and the duplication argument. Those flow from, in fact, the fact that there was no apportionment that was done, and that all the damages really relate to this concept of amorphous lost profits. Now let me turn to the apportionment argument. At bottom, plaintiff's theory is that subparagraph 4 of the comparative fault statute, 111.5, can be read both in isolation and that strict compliance with its terms is not necessary. I submit to the court that that is respectfully wrong. Looking at 111.5, if you look at subsection 1, subsection 2, and subsection 4, and I believe you have to read the entire comparative fault statute with looking at 1, 2, and 4, and all three of those subsections apply in this particular situation.
Can I stop you for a moment? I'm sorry, Mr. Westfall. Are you arguing that as to each of the separate claims, apportionment was required amongst the defendants named in the listed in the verdict form?
Yes.
For example, on the conspiracy
claim. With respect to all torts claims.
The tort claims. So with respect to the claim that was against Otologics and its officer Bedoya, I guess was his name, you're saying there had to be a portion between Otologics on the one hand and Bedoya on the other?
Yes, we are, Your Honor.
Let me just stop you there. The theory was that, I mean, a corporation can only act through its agent, or a principal can only act through its agent, and a company only through its employee. What's the point of apportioning? How could they possibly apportion, and what would be the point of apportioning? We have a principal and agent theory.
Well, it certainly matters in this particular situation, Will, because we have a bankruptcy situation where the jury could very well have found and should have been instructed to find how much is respect to Otologics and how much is with respect to Bedoya.
Otologics can only act through Bedoya. So whatever Bedoya did would be Otologics' percentage anyway, as I understand the principal and agent theory. That's how it would work. Master certainly would be the same thing. How could it possibly be that Otologics would have a different percentage than Bedoya if he's the actor who created their liability? That's what I don't understand about that part of the case.
There still should have been apportionment, and there still should have, if
why?
For contribution purposes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that contribution, now, let me actually turn to, I think the judge raises a very good point.
Or let's take the conspiracy claim. There I understand a little better. You're saying there should have been apportionment so that these nine defendants could see contribution from each other. That would be the reason. That would be the reason. That would be the only reason I could think of to have apportionment.
Yes.
Just contribution.
Well, contribution, I think, yes, but I also, we believe very strongly that the law is absolutely clear that the defendant has a right to apportionment. And in this case, there is the specific statutory benefit that comes from the second sentence of subsection 4 that says, any person held jointly liable under this subsection 4 shall have a right of contribution from the several defendants acting in concert. The statute on its face gives us the right of contribution. But it's something more than that in this case.
But when
we
you have the right of contribution against the non-party at fault whose percentage is identified, it's not binding on that case anyway. Do you think this statute would make the contribution percentages binding?
The contribution determination made by the special verdict that's required under Section 2 is the determination by the jury that then gets used in a subsequent contribution proceeding among the parties.
But it's
and again,
not,
that matters in this particular situation involving Mr. Bedoya and Otologics, because Otologics is in bankruptcy, Mr. Bedoya is not, and there's definitely issues related to the administration of that estate where this issue matters. And again, getting back to the point I was making before at the beginning, my client, Otologic, and the individual defendants have a statutory right under the plain language of 111.5 to apportionment. We tendered an apportionment instruction, we tendered jury instructions that call for apportionment, and more importantly, my client filed a motion for directed verdict immediately the day before the jury instruction conference. And that motion for directed verdict appears at record 7874. And if you look at that record, you look at the actual motion for directed verdict saying Otologics has a right to apportionment, to not only for contribution purposes, which would also, again, getting back, it would have avoided the duplication, and it would have avoided the inconsistent verdict issues that we raised. Had the jury been required to walk through and apportion specific dollar numbers and specific percentages for specific torts, we submit that the duplication problem would have occurred and the inconsistent verdict issue would not have occurred, independent from the issue of the contribution issue. And so the client, Otologics, moved for a directed verdict at page 7874 of the record. And a critical part of the record is also the colloquy involving counsel for the plaintiffs, where the issue finally comes to a head, and counsel for Otologics, this is at page 56 of the February 18th transcript of the jury instructions conference, where counsel for Otologics makes the statement, We believe its critical and dispositive error referring to the issue of apportionment. In response, plaintiff's counsel made the following statement. Right, and we believe it's going to be dispositive error if the jury believes that they have to apportion the tort claims. They have to apportion the contract claim. They don't have to apportion the tort claims. And this is going to project error because they're going to think that they have to. And so the counsel for the plaintiff absolutely steadfastly stands in the face of the comparative fault statute and says, no, it would be error to issue a comparative fault instruction, to issue an apportionment instruction. And I submit to this court that it was preserved by the motion for directed verdict and the colloquy and jury instructions and the verdict form that was submitted by Odologics. It was, in fact, underscored by the motion for directed verdict. And at the jury instruction conference, counsel for plaintiff won at the trial court level and persuaded the trial court judge, nope, we don't have to apportion. And that was completely underscored when the court issued its ruling on the direct motion for directed verdict at record 12065, where the judge did what he did at the jury instruction conference. It's an issue for argument. You can argue apportionment all you want, but I'm not going to issue any instructions, and I'm not going to do what subsection 2 of the comparative fault statute requires. I'm not going to issue a special verdict or have a special verdict form that will determine the percentage of negligence of fault attributable to each of the parties. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
I have to ask you a question. I'm sorry.
No, please.
We can do it later now. With respect to the duplicate of damages, you agree that the measure of damages given for the aiding and abetting fiduciary duty breach was different from the measure of damages given for the intentional interference with contract, was it not? The measures of damage were different.
Very different, Your Honor. And the only material difference is this issue of how much value Odologics may have received as a result of that. And there's no evidence that they submitted.
Okay.
The only evidence they could come up with was the issues related to the theft of trade secrets. The jury awarded zero on that.
So, nonetheless, what you're saying is there was no evidence to support the verdict, an insufficiency of evidence argument, which, remember, I asked you at the outset, are you making such an argument? I think you tried to say you're not.
I think the court is free, with me having to be forced into the corner of arguing an insufficiency of evidence argument. I think I am free to take a position on appeal when I'm asking for a motion for new trial and damages, when as an argument in addition to the failure to apportion, I'm pointing out to the court that in light of the evidence that was actually adduced, which was lost profits evidence, that it's clearly duplicative. You just look at it, and the same relationships of employer-employee, the same lost profits theory, it's clearly duplicative. And to sort of read one, subsection one instruction and say, wow, that's different, I respectfully submit that that's too thin a read for them to hang the hat on.
Thank you, Mr. Westfall.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Bobby Musgrave. 12440 is my registration number. And together with Larry Tyson, Sean Ward, we represent Neuralec. Your Honors, what the defendants are urging on this court with respect to the interpretation of subsection 4 is unprecedented. Their interpretation of subsection 4 would eviscerate the theory of joint liability, and it would put a burden on a plaintiff that the Colorado Supreme Court has never, ever imposed. I want to put this in context, because what happened here was in 1986, the Colorado legislature passed the apportionment statute. But very, very quickly, they realized that apportionment was not going to work in every case. So the very next year, they passed subsection 4. Subsection 4 is an exception to the apportionment statute. And therefore, if subsection 4 applies, you don't even focus on subsections 1, 2, or 3. And I'd like the court to look at subsection 4 closely, particularly the second sentence of subsection 4. That sentence reads, any person held jointly liable under this section shall have the right of contribution from his fellow defendants acting in concert. Now, Mr. Westfall is arguing that you have to apportion first and then look to see if there's joint liability. But that's putting the cart before the horse. Here, the statute says a person is first held to be jointly liable, and then that person gets to look to his co-conspirators for contribution.
In a separate case. Where that jury decides the proportional liability between them.
Pardon?
Where, in that second case, the jury would decide the proportional liability between them.
Exactly. And so what Section 4 does, Your Honor, is it's basically a timing thing. You have a trial that determines liability and the damages overall. And then in a second proceeding, which, by the way, Neuralect does not even need to be a part of, this is a proceeding among the defendants to sort out who it is that's responsible for what. And Neuralect doesn't need to be there.
What does the last sentence mean then?
That is a follow-on to the second sentence, so that as part of the second proceeding, that's where the defendants are going to determine their various percentages of contribution.
Ms. Musgrave, why isn't it easier for the jury, who hears all the evidence, to make apportionment and have the trial court decide what part of it is joint and several?
Your Honor, because I think, one, that's inconsistent with statute. Two, it's inconsistent with common law. And three, I believe that that would create an unfair burden and prejudice on plaintiff.
How would it create an unfair burden if the trial court is able, through an order that says this portion is joint and several? That doesn't create any burden to the plaintiff. But on the other hand, it gives the jury the opportunity to make the decision during the course of a trial where they hear all the evidence, who's responsible for what.
And Your Honor, that's exactly what happened here. If you go back and you look at the jury verdict form, in each one of the torts, every defendant is listed. Was this defendant responsible? Yes, no. Was this defendant responsible? The jury was able to select which defendants were engaged in a joint liability as to each of the torts as it related to the plaintiff.
Well, just as an example, and looking at these verdict forms, I see that in one instance, there are three defendants who the jury said they're liable, and I'm left wondering, does each defendant pay $150,000?
That's going to be determined by the defendants in the second proceeding, Your Honor. That's our position.
Well, wait a second. Three defendants were found liable for breach of fiduciary duty. Was it your theory that this was joint and several liability?
It was joint liability on that theory, yes, Your Honor.
For $150,000 total, plus the punitives, I guess.
I believe it was $300,000 total.
Well, it was $150,000 and $150,000.
I believe there are three defendants, Your Honor.
What's the theory that would hold them jointly and severally liable? Are you saying they conspired to breach their fiduciary?
Yes, Your Honor, and if I may, if you go back to our amended complaint, and that is 327 in the record, our very, very first paragraph sets out that there was a conspiracy among the defendants to breach agreements, to breach fiduciary duties, to tortiously interfere. If you look at the theory of the case instruction that Judge Whitney gave, and I can give you that side as well, it was the first day of trial, and it is at page 29 of the transcript. Judge Whitney, in the theory of the case instruction given to the jury on the very first day of trial, tells the jury that our theory of the case is that these defendants were jointly liable for aiding and abetting, breach of fiduciary duty, tortious interference, conspiracy. He says that in the theory of the case. We repeated that in our oral argument.
That theory of the case instruction was not given to the jury as part of the closing instruction packet, correct?
No, it was at the beginning of the case. But it is telling the jury what it is that the plaintiff's case is all about.
So let me make sure that I understand this. There was a separate conspiracy claim, was there not?
Yes, there was.
So your argument is that because the jury concluded that there was conspiracy, that operates to make joint several liability for all the remaining tort claims.
That's one of our arguments, but it's not the only argument that we have.
Let me ask this. As far as punitive damages go, I'm looking at the jury verdict, and I see that the jury came to the conclusion that there should be $250,000 of punitive damages with respect to willful and wanton conduct.
Yes.
Per defendant?
No.
So it's not per defendant for the punitive damages, but it is per defendant for the compensatory damages.
No, Your Honor. Maybe I misspoke, or maybe I didn't understand the question.
You see the problem I'm having with this? I can't go through these jury instructions and figure out what happened.
Your Honor,
as it relates to each of the separate claims, and if you look at the judgment and order in the case, it makes it clear. As to each claim, each tort claim, the defendants that the jury found were part of the conspiracy under that tort claim, that they were jointly liable for the amount of that particular tort claim. So if you look at the breach of fiduciary duty claim that we were just looking at, according to the judgment that was entered in the case, the three defendants that were found liable under the breach of fiduciary duty, it's those three defendants that are jointly liable for the tortious interference. I'm sorry, for the breach of fiduciary duty claim.
It doesn't say in the judgment that they're jointly and severally liable.
Excuse me?
It does not say in this proposed form of judgment that the D. DuPeyron and Mumain, if I pronounce their names right, are jointly and severally liable.
That I agree, Your Honor, but it does, when you go back and you look at the theory of the case that we presented, the evidence that was presented in this case overwhelmingly established that we were putting on a joint liability case as it related to all of the defendants. And if you look, again, there's no obligation either in the statute or at common law that required the jury verdict form to specifically say that there's a finding of joint liability. Subsection 4 doesn't
require. No, but the judge should make that clear in the judgment, I would think, and it's not clear to me here.
Well, the judge did make it clear at the jury instructions conference, though, Your Honor.
Counsel, can I interrupt here?
Yes.
If I understand what you're saying is all of the torts were part of the conspiracy.
Yes.
So wouldn't that suggest that all of the damages resulting from those torts should be damages resulting from the conspiracy? And you see, my question is, there's a separate damage award for conspiracy, which is, of course, much less than the total damages for all the other torts, which doesn't make any sense to me if all the torts were part of the same conspiracy.
And I appreciate that question, and but there's a very good reason for why there's a difference, and it follows up on something that Judge Richman was asking Mr. Westfall. If you look at the various torts, and you look at the elements of damage that relate to each one of those torts, the elements of damage are different for each one.
The measures of damage.
I'm sorry, the measure of damage. I apologize, Your Honor. And for example, let me take the conspiracy claim. One of the ways you can show conspiracy is through lawful acts that result in an unlawful goal. That's for a conspiracy claim. That was hotly contested at trial. The defendant's argument was, look, we could all leave Norlec. There's nothing that kept us there, no handcuffs or anything, and therefore there's no way that that lawful goal would lead to, that lawful act would lead to an illegal goal. Our argument, though, throughout the trial was, as it relates to the conspiracy claim, was that it wasn't just that these defendants left Neuralife. We conceded that each individual defendant could leave. But what we were pointing the jury to was the fact that they were plotting and planning an en masse departure, that they were trying to include many more people other than the seven that ultimately left, that they planned to leave all at the same time because they wanted to infer the most amount of damage on Neuralife that they possibly could. And so that evidence went to the conspiracy claim, and that was the evidence that the jury was looking at as it was considering the conspiracy claim itself.
Where do we find the measure of damages for conspiracy given to the jury?
It's not there, and yes, it's not in CJI.
How do we know how they came? That's my problem. If you had a separate measure of damage for conspiracy, we might be able to figure out how they came up with $1.25 million, but or whatever it was. But I don't see them. There was no measure of damages for conspiracy specifically given.
And there is no measure of damages for civil conspiracy in CJI. But I believe, again, following up on some of the comments that Your Honor made in the prior case, when you're dealing with measure of damages, if there's anything in the record that supports those damages, that damage award has to be affirmed. And even if there's not a number, a $1 million number for conspiracy, if that specific number is not there, the jury is still entitled to look at that. And Your Honor,
but in order to figure out what the jury did here, the jury awarded $1 million on the conspiracy claim in damages. And then the jury awarded $1.5 million on the aiding and abetting, obviously a bigger number. Doesn't that suggest that the jury did not find the damages related to aiding and abetting to be related to the conspiracy, or else they would have included the $1.5 million in that award for the conspiracy?
The aiding and abetting damages are separate and apart from the conspiracy damages. There's plenty.
But your theory is that the jury would have believed and found that the aiding and abetting was part of the conspiracy.
The conspiracy claim that where we got awarded $1 million was a separate tort. When I use the conspiracy as it relates to the other torts, I'm talking generically.
So where is the finding of this generic conspiracy, since we're not looking at the specific finding on the conspiracy claim?
It's Judge Whitney found it, and the jury found it when they were saying these three defendants were the ones that were responsible. The one other point I want to make is the record is not complete. We filed a notice that the record is not complete. There are transcripts out there, and there are trial exhibits that were admitted at trial that also go and point to damages, dollar amounts of damages, $2 million, for example, for replacing these people who left. So there are evidence in the record that is not before the court that supports our jury damages. And because of there's a presumption that missing testimony supports the judgment and the verdict, the court should affirm. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Musgrave. Mr. Westfall, I'm going to add 20 seconds to your time so that you've got an equal amount of time to argue.
Thank you, Your Honor, but I'm not sure I'm even going to need it.
Okay.
I think the colloquy that you just experienced is our point. The theory of the case, there's a giant conspiracy to harm and gut Neuralink and put a hole in Neuralink, a conspiracy to destroy Neuralink. That was what was done repeatedly at the beginning of the case, throughout the conduct of the trial, and that's what we fought against. And that's why we tried to come up with the jury verdict and the instructions that we did, that while long, would not have entailed much of, it would have taken a couple hours for the jury to walk through, and it would have forced the jury to pick out and apportion the actual damages that would have avoided what I'm afraid that Your Honor were shown exactly what we were subjected to. That's why we're merely asking for a new trial on damages make it clear that there needs to, we need to comply with the comparative fault statute, provide some guidance, and we'll take our shot down again on a retrial on damages.
Your proposed verdict form was more than 80 pages long, was it not?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
And
many of the, may I?
Go ahead.
But many of the points have a certain, you know, decision tree, yes or no. If no, skip way beyond and move on. It would involve a simple, methodical walking through that would have dealt with the problem that we were facing that I think the court has now been presented with. And with respect to the actual language of subsection 4, I would just call the court's attention to page 28 of their brief, where that's the only point or in their brief that they actually try to wrestle with the actual language of subparagraph 4. And I think we take it apart in our reply brief and in our opening brief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Westfall. Thank you again, Ms. Musgrave. Thanks to both counsel for your excellent arguments today. They were helpful to the court. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.